All right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. You may be seated. Good morning to everyone. We will begin with introductions from the court. I'm Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and now, by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller-Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Good morning. Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik. Good morning.
And John Freidenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. Our first case of the day is State versus Trail. Mr. Murray, you are here with us this morning. Good morning, and you may approach. And Mr. Smith, you're here. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Both sides are allotted up to 20 minutes. And you may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Ben Murray. I am the court-appointed attorney for the appellant, Aubrey Trail. This is a mandatory appeal pursuant to 29-25-25, as it is a capital case. Mr. Trail was convicted of first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit that murder, and improper disposal of human remains. He was sentenced to death plus 52 years. So in my brief, I essentially fired every arrow in my quiver. I alleged a lot of errors, but would like to focus on the errors that are fact-specific to this case rather than some of the more general arguments that this court has contemplated before. I'd like to provide a little bit of background. As the court may be aware, this was a very public case. There was a lot of press coverage. There was a lot of public interest. We had a victim who at one point had been missing for several weeks. We had a defendant and a co-defendant who were then on the run. While they were on the run, they were releasing videos and while they were being chased by the FBI. We have the defendant, Mr. Trail, who is the leader of a group of young women who were involved in theft, fraud, witchcraft, sorcery, torture. We also had an interesting twist where the luring of the victim was done over social media, which was kind of a new issue that we were dealing with. So that caused a lot of national press coverage. We had a full courtroom most days. We had people holding signs across the street picketing that the jurors had to walk by every day. And counsel had people filming us even as we came to and left our hotel every morning and followed us to the courthouse. So the jury was death qualified over our objection. And in voir dire, they were informed that there was going to be talk of torture, of witchcraft, of vampires, unusual sexual practices, and even of the possibility that the victim's blood, they had drank the victim's blood. We also then, after jury selection, had a client who refused to come to court and was waiving his appearance for most of the first week. So that was another interesting twist. Then we get to the first day of the second week, and between witnesses, Mr. Trail stood up, yelled, "Bailey is innocent," Bailey being the co-defendant, "Bailey is innocent, and I curse you all," to the courtroom and the jury. He produced a razor blade that had been hidden in his mouth, and he sliced his throat. The security video, which was entered into evidence later, showed that the jurors were running and covering their faces, and so there was no question that they saw it. We later learned through deposition that this only happened, well, he only had the razor blade in the courtroom because law enforcement hadn't followed any of their protocols. They hadn't searched him. They hadn't been searching him. And essentially, the one person in the room who had admitted to murdering someone and dismembering them is the one person that didn't go through a metal detector, while all the rest of us did.
There was never an argument that the jail staff or the security staff encouraged him to do this, was there?
No.
The argument was that they negligently allowed it to happen, but they never put the idea in his head or encouraged him to do it.
No, you're correct. I think that it was more negligent because he had also given some warnings that morning that, hey, I'm going to wear my white shirt so the blood shows up, in the context of he said someone was going to shoot him in the head. So we made that argument in our motion for new trial because at the time we made the motion for mistrial, we had no idea that, I think everyone just assumed that he was going through security because we all were. It wasn't that they were encouraging it. It was that, that either through laziness or whatever, they weren't following any of their protocols.
But you would agree that's an important distinction, isn't it?
It is, except in that in a lot of the case law on the mistrial, the cases say that, essentially a defendant cannot cause his own mistrial. But I think in the one of the cases that the court relied on, I think it was Blackman maybe, that the district court relied on, it said it was solely caused. It was completely caused, completely his own doing. Well, in this case, that isn't true. It was true that the outburst was completely his own doing, but the fact that they had given him a razor blade 3 days earlier and hadn't taken it back, which they did with apparently every other inmate, we thought at least they played some part in it, but we'd agree it was negligent.
Was Mr. Trail in a wheelchair?
He was. So he was in a wheelchair, and they had stun belts on him, but for whatever reason, they didn't fire it when he stood up. I think part of that is just because we were between witnesses, and it was kind of a down moment. It was not the most exciting part of the trial. I think we were between hotel employees who had seen him when he was on the run. But on our motion for mistrial, we relied on a Seventh Circuit case, the U.S. v. Manny, that just says, essentially, where are we at? Certain courtroom situations are so beyond the pale, so prejudicial, that no amount of voir dire and no and cautionary instructions can remedy the defect. And that's what we think we had here. The state in its brief says, they describe this as Mr. Trail standing up, stating, Bailey is innocent and I curse you all, followed by Trail making slashing motions to his neck with an object that resulted in some blood. Well, I admire their gift for understatement, but this was a lot bigger than that. I mean, it led the national news, all the networks, the cable news. This was a more dramatic experience than that.
How is a court to handle that situation?
I think
is it just automatically a mistrial, and now we're the whim of what the defendant can think about to make it an egregious situation, or do they have to try to manage the situation and voir dire through the witnesses and things of that? Are the jurors?
I think the court has to try to manage it. The problem is, it was just so beyond anything. I mean, we're in a situation where we're talking about witchcraft, we're talking about torture, we're talking about this horrible murder, and they see this man make a suicide attempt, and on top of that, he is cursing them, whether or not these people believe in witchcraft or whatever. It makes it a little more impactful that he has cursed them.
But did you interview all the jurors? Is that what happened?
Kind of. What happened first was the judge ordered them to disregard what had happened. So she gave them an order to disregard it. Then
Was there any inadequacy in the judge's admonishment to the jury to disregard?
Yes, and mostly in the voir dire to the jurors. So first, there was, it seems strange to mention it, there was never an objection to the outburst. There was never a motion to strike, which is something that's required, at least in this court, in the State v. Daly case. But the voir dire is the problem, because they weren't really asked anything about the specific incident. They were just, so they had been ordered to comply or to disregard this, and then
you seem to take issue with the fact that that admonishment was made before voir dire of the jurors occurred.
I think the fact that it was, I feel like you're ordering the jurors, who obviously respect your position as the judge, you're ordering them to disregard this. It seems strange then that you would go back to them and essentially ask them, are you able to follow this order? Well, they have no choice but to say yes. And then the voir dire was mostly, did you hear my order? Can you follow it? Do you think you can still be impartial? Well, that didn't get into the fact that, you know, these people had what they had seen. I mean, the video shows they had seen everything. I mean, they had seen, I mean, I was 6 inches from this guy. There was a lot of blood. He required nearly 100 stitches.
What do you think the judge should have asked?
I think the judge should have gone into with each individual juror and said, and should have asked, what did you see? How did that affect you? Do you still think you can be impartial? And then say, you know, we've talked to all of you. We believe you can be impartial, and then, you know, disregard this, and this can't factor into your decision.
But the judge did ask if they could be impartial.
The judge did ask if they could be impartial. We just feel it didn't go far enough, and we feel like really any instruction or questioning at that point was pointless. It just...
So automatic mistrial.
I believe so on this. I think had it just been an outburst, and, you know, anything other than that, but
was there any kind of break between the judge's admonition that you should disregard what you just saw, and then were they immediately voir dired, or was there a recess of some kind?
I think there was a recess. It was the same day, but I think we may have had a break for lunch or something like that, and then we came back and took them in individually. If I remember right, I think that's what happened. But it was a relatively quick process. The thing is, you know, it would not be unusual for a juror to see an outburst, you know, especially with this defendant. I mean, they were expecting it. Everyone has seen people yell before. Nobody had seen anyone slit their throat in front of them before. That's why I think in this case the only remedy was the mistrial. And in fact, when we first went back into chambers, when everyone is clearing the room, we all assumed that he was dead. That was what we thought. It turned out later that it was not. I think he was back. He was at least out of the hospital later that evening. But
is your view of this event, pardon me, in the applicable law, that there's a continuum when there's an event of this nature, right? So there may be an outburst to be managed, but in your view, this event required an automatic mistrial. And if that is the law, where does that leave the trial judge, or doesn't it leave the system of the trial at risk for staged mistrials?
Well, yes, I believe it should have been an automatic mistrial, but I think that's cured through a more in-depth voir dire of the jurors. I think we just don't have any information.
It was curable, in your view. Is that your position?
I don't think this one is. I agree that it's a spectrum, and I think this is just so far at one end that it would it would never not end in a mistrial, just because it was so shocking. But I believe normally an outburst, something like that, can be cured. That was one of the things that the Manny case talked about, and about how the it depends on the context of the trial. In the Manny case, they said, you know, if this outburst had happened in a tax, you know, some sort of a tax fraud case, it wouldn't be a problem. But in that one, they said, you know, their allegation that this guy is involved in a street gang, so that makes it even worse. And here we're dealing with, you know, a man who has admitted to killing someone and dismembering him. It's hard to argue after they've seen him slit his own throat that he's incapable of violence.
If there's a possibility of automatic mistrials, what protection is there against a defendant perceiving that things aren't going well and staging what he needs to stage to get an automatic mistrial?
Metal detectors, but also I think the voir dire. I think the questioning of the court needs to be more in depth.
But I hear you to be arguing that there's at least some incidents that are so egregious that they can't be cured by voir dire. And so what protection is there if there's the possibility of an automatic mistrial? What protection do we have against defendants perceiving things aren't going well and doing what needs to be done to create that situation?
Well, I mean, just the protections that we already have. I mean, I guess. I don't know specifically. I can't come up with something to tell you we can do, but I would think, you know, following the protocols that we already have in place should do it. This is a pretty unusual event. It's not, you know, every day that a defendant is going to have a weapon on them or something like that. I think the court did everything that it thought it could do to prevent this. I mean, we had some indication that something could happen early in this case just on the prior behavior of this guy, but then we, you know, it, just everything, they hadn't followed any of their rules, and so we're kind of stuck with this. And it just seems like at some point, and this is that point, there's just nothing you can do. I mean, the jurors saw, they saw all the blood, and they saw what happened. I just don't think there's a cure for it.
At the time when the curative procedures were being imposed by the court, did you make any recommendations to the court for deeper voir dire or anything like that?
No. So
were you allowed to ask any questions?
No, we were not. So the court just handled it on her own. And they only allowed one attorney from each side in the room, and that was basically it.
Were the interviews of the jurors done in chambers?
They were done in chambers. So the judge and one lawyer from each side, and it was essentially three questions.
One juror at a time.
One juror at a time, and. I mean, I don't know if a deeper questioning would have cured this. I mean, these jurors were pretty excited to be involved in this case, it seemed at the time. So I don't think any of them wanted to go. It would seem to be getting more exciting as they went on. But that was just something we were kind of stuck with. I mean, just to kind of show the environment we were faced with as defense counsel. At the same time, this was not listed as an error, we made a motion for a competency evaluation. And I believe the court said, I have not seen anything today that would call his competency into question, so I'm going to overrule that motion. So that's kind of what we were faced with. We have a difficult client, but we are also faced with jurors that really want to be there, you know, and the court obviously didn't want to start this over again. That was, I think, the bigger issue. I think had this been, you know, a normal assault case or something like this, a three-day jury trial, I think this thing would have been a mistrial every time. But we'd all been working on this thing for 2 years. We had all cleared our schedules for a month. We've got one of the most difficult defendants that anyone really has probably had to deal with. And so I'm concerned that that was the bigger issue, that we got to keep going. We have to get this thing done. And so I think that was the error. I think that's the problem.
Is that a bit of an expansion upon your argument you provided in the brief?
It is. But I mean, I think that's just my opinion. I think that was one of the factors that that weighed into it. I think that's just one of the things you're dealing with at trial. I mean, I think we've all probably had mistrials for much less than this. I certainly have. So that's what we were kind of stuck with. And then mostly the argument on the motion for new trial was the same thing. It's just we brought in that new evidence of what had happened that led up to him having the razor blade. And so we argued that under irregularity. And then really, we also made the argument for new evidence that couldn't have been discovered and would have been used at trial, realistically, knowing that it would have only been able to be used in the motion for mistrial. So it would be new evidence only in that context in our motion for the mistrial. So that was the motion. I think that's about my time. Obviously, all of the other arguments are in the brief. I think you've heard most of those before. We believe that, Mr. Trail was denied a fair trial, although we understand most people their feelings aren't hurt by him getting the death penalty. These are the most important cases. This is where due process and equal protection are the most important, and we would ask that the case be remanded for new trial. Thank you, Your Honors. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Mr. Smith, good morning to you.
May it please the court, I'm James D. Smith, Senior Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee of the state of Nebraska. Concerning the main issue talked about in the appellant's argument, I think it probably needs to be reinforced that the standard of review is abuse of discretion for denial of a motion for new trial. Frankly, the district court did one of the most impressive jobs I've ever seen of managing a trial and outburst. Should be highly complimented for the way she handled this. She immediately adjourned the proceedings. The defendant was taken out for medical care. Court reconvenes in the afternoon. The judge gives the jury a cautionary instruction, which included they should not consider the defendant's outburst when they consider the issue of the defendant's guilt or innocence. The judge then, on top of that, does individual questioning of the jurors, makes a finding that is supported by the record, and uses her discretion under the circumstances to deny the motion for mistrial. Abuse of discretion is typically known as a court doing something that's untenable. What the district judge did in this case was totally tenable and reflected a very experienced trial judge showing good judgment in managing a trial in which something unforeseen happens, and that's namely the defendant trying to cause his own mistrial, which the law in Nebraska is the defendant doesn't get rewarded for bad behavior, and the defendant in this case was not rewarded, certainly should not be rewarded. There was no abuse of discretion here, rather it's simply a district judge who should be complimented for how well she handled and managed what could have been a very difficult trial.
What role does the alleged negligence of the county have on this issue?
None.
Why not?
Essentially under State v. Grant, when you try to blame others for your own misconduct, that's a non-starter. and that's what the defendant is trying to do by blaming others for his own misconduct. Under State v. Grant, the blaming others for his own bad behavior is it's not a tort trial at that point where we're suing for negligence or anything like that. It's did the defendant engage in bad behavior? Yes. Was it willful? Yes. Again, the defendant caused his own mistrial? No. Did the judge under the circumstances take proper measures to manage the trial? Yes. It's presumed the jury follows the judge's instructions. The judge instructed the jury not to consider the outburst, which was proper. And inquired of the jurors, made finding that the jurors could remain fair and impartial. There's just, there's nothing there. It's under the appellate standard of review. There just is no abuse of discretion. Unless the court has other questions, frankly, the remaining assignments of error, I think, are covered in my brief, and they reflect that the defendant really doesn't have much to talk about after we had a district judge who really did an excellent job of presiding over this trial.
I do have a question about the death qualifying of the jury during voir dire.
Sure.
And I see in your brief that you're saying this wasn't actually a death qualification anyway, but assuming that it was a death qualification proceeding, does the fact that they waived the jury for the aggravator stage have any impact upon that?
Well, I think it's difficult to argue. Yeah, I I've made that argument before. If you waive a jury, how are you able to then complain about the jury voir dire? Because you made an intelligent decision, informed decision, to waive a jury. So how can you complain about the jury voir dire? And they also waived him on cause. So they passed the jury for cause. So that, again, is another issue. Just it doesn't go anywhere.
Well, following up on an argument they made in their brief that the death qualification of the jury didn't need to occur because you just, under our system, the jury could just not be informed the death penalty is part of this. And once you remove the aggravator stage out of it, is that a possibility even? If you move the aggravator stage out of it, the whole jury in Nebraska in kind of ignorance of the fact that this is a death penalty case?
No, because I think it is still appropriate under our statute and constitutionally to inquire of jurors whether they're going to remain fair and impartial because there is a possible penalty of death, even though they're not going to be the ones making that decision. The fact that the defendant could be sentenced to death, it's a proper under our statute and constitutionally to inquire as to whether because of that potential, does that mean you can not be fair and impartial on the thing you have to decide, which is guilt or innocence.
Thank you.
In conclusion, we would ask the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. Counsel, thank you very much. That concludes arguments. State versus Trail. I'm not sure, Mr. Murrier, you appointed in this matter?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you very much for your service. The court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Edwards versus the State of Clark. Mr. Becker, good morning to you.